superfluidity in a Bose gas. The story will be more or less similar to what we have done so far. We'll be deriving a field theory to describe the properties of some condensed matter system. In this case, it'll be the theory of an interacting Bose gas, which is not far from the ideal Bose gas, but there will be some interactions. And again, there will be spontaneous symmetry breaking, and there will be the appearance of Goldstone modes. So you will again see that these concepts, which were borrowed from particle physics, are quite important in condensed matter. Superfluidity in helium-4 was discovered in 1937, simultaneously in Russia and in the UK. You can read the story of the subject, for instance, on Wikipedia, and you can also watch a wonderful movie by Alfred Leitner, a professor at Michigan State, which was filmed in 1963, in fact. So it's a rather ancient movie that you can find on YouTube if you Google his name. So let me show you a brief excerpt from this. Not sure if you can.
Another reflection of the fact that we are dealing with a change in the phase of the substance. By the way, the curve resembles the Greek letter lambda. The temperature got its name from the shape of this curve. We're in for more surprises. The next one has to do with the viscosity of liquid helium. When a normal liquid flows through a tube, it will resist the flow. In this experiment, we shall cause is now at 1.6 degrees. The superflow is even faster. The viscosity of helium-2 in this experiment is so small that it has not been possible to find a value for it. It is less than the experimental uncertainty incurred in attempts to measure it. We now believe that helium-2, the superfluid, has zero viscosity, although we should be more precise here. We believe its viscosity is zero when observing capillary flow. Bear this statement in mind, for we will come up with a contradiction to it in the next experiment, where we will look for viscosity by a different method.
Well, that's a fine enough introduction, and you can watch the entire movie, which is about 40 minutes long, and find out about the properties of superfluid helium, which are quite amazing. Okay, so helium-2, which is a phase of liquid helium, possesses a wonderful property of superfluidity. So as you saw demonstrated in this short excerpt from the movie, it can flow without viscosity through really tiny pores. And we will think about a slightly different setup in which we have a macroscopic object. Of large mass M going through the superfluid. So it has velocity V, and the lack of viscosity means that its momentum does not change, right? So it's unable to transfer its momentum to the fluid. And we will derive some phenomenological theory, which belongs to Lev Landau, that explains how this can happen if we assume certain properties of the excitation spectrum for particles that make up excitations of the Bose gas. So suppose it flows through a quantum fluid in its vacuum state. Or the ground state. So the vacuum state of the fluid will have momentum zero and whatever ground state energy is. Right? If you want to slow down this macroscopic object, it can happen if the macroscopic object, as it flows through the fluid, it creates a quantum of excitation, a quantum of energy, right? So there will be some new particle created in the fluid, which will have some momentum p and energy epsilon of p. Right? We've seen examples of these particles previously. In a ferromagnet, that would be a magnon, for instance. Or in a crystal, it could be a phonon. Both types of excitation carry momentum and carry energy, right? So if we're trying to excite the liquid by transferring momentum to it and transferring energy to it, the excitations come in the form of these particles, right? Quantum particles at very low temperatures. So as a result of this, our macroscopic object will slow down somewhat. Its velocity will be changed from V to V plus delta V, where delta V presumably will be directed against its motion. So if this process is possible, it has to satisfy the constraints of energy and momentum conservation. So momentum conservation tells us that mass times velocity, that's momentum of our object before, will be equal to the new momentum, m times v plus delta v, plus the momentum of the excitation that has been produced. Energy conservation tells us that the kinetic energy of the particle moving, sorry, of the object moving through the fluid will be equal to the total energy of the object, which is mv plus delta v squared over 2, plus the excitation energy of this new particle. Right, so if you expand both sides, you will have here mv squared over 2 equals mv squared over 2, which will cancel out against the left-hand side, and there will be mv dot delta v plus m delta v squared over 2. So from momentum conservation, the change in the object's velocity would be minus p divided by capital M. And since the mass of a macroscopic object is so large, it's going to be a really tiny change in the velocity. So plugging this into the energy balance, we will have minus p dot delta V. That's the first non-vanishing term, plus p squared divided by 2m, plus the energy of the particle, this whole thing equal to 0. Sorry, this is p dot v. And so if the object is really big, mass is pretty much infinite, we can neglect this piece. Set it to 0 as m goes to infinity. And so then the condition for the possibility of momentum transfer is this, epsilon p equals p dot v. Right. This would make momentum transfer possible. So as an example, let's consider an ideal Bose gas. In which the excitation energy is simply p squared divided by 2m. We have non-interacting particles. All they have is just the kinetic energy. So if I draw the energy momentum relation here. So in one dimension, it'll look like this. This is P, and then there'll be a parabolic dispersion like this, P squared over 2m. And if I draw V dot P, it's a straight line in one dimension going through the origin. It's going to intersect this curve at this point, and this will be momentum equal to 2 times mv, if you work this out. Right, so it's possible to find a momentum for which you can create an excitation, and both the momentum conservation and energy conservation would be fine. Right, so in an ideal Bose gas, it turns out that you have viscosity. So it's able to create a viscous force. So can you imagine a situation where this momentum transfer is not possible? That is when this equation will have no solutions for any non-zero momentum. How would you change this curve in order to prevent momentum transfer?
You put a linear energy.
How about a linear energy momentum dispersion, right? So this is ideal Bose gas. And so we can draw something different if we have the energy momentum curve that actually is not a curve, but is rather a cone, like this, right? So it's p times some speed. Then drawing a straight line p dot v, so this is done in one dimension, p dot v is the same as p times v. We will find no solutions aside from zero, but transferring zero momentum means nothing, right? So you don't slow the particle down. So as long as the velocity is less than the speed s, there will be no viscosity. So that's a rather simple theory that explains how it's possible not to have any viscosity. The only problem is we have to explain how the energy spectrum of particles in liquid helium switches from quadratic at the bottom to something that looks linear at the bottom. Okay? But that's a phenomenology. And so the actual theory lies still ahead. Questions? Let's try to understand how this is possible. One clue to the origin of superfluidity in liquid helium comes from a very strong isotope effect. That is, superfluidity at the temperature of 2.17 kelvins develops in the isotope of helium with atomic mass 4, but it does not develop in the isotope with atomic mass 3. Helium-3 turns out not to be superfluid until a much, much, much lower temperature of 2.5 millikelvins. What's the difference between helium 4 and helium 3? We have bosons versus fermions, right? The difference in mass itself is only 25%, so it probably cannot explain a 3 orders of magnitude difference in the superfluid temperatures. So presumably it has to do something with the Bose character of quantum statistics in this case, and that indeed turns out to be true. So we'll start by building the field theory of an ideal Bose gas and then add interactions to that. So we'll start with a classical field theory here. Classical complex scalar field. Psi of r with the following Lagrangian. A Lagrangian density. Will be I h bar psi star times the time derivative psi dot minus h bar squared grad psi star dot grad psi divided by 2n. We can write down the equations of motion for the fields psi and psi star. Sorry?
You don't have time derivative on phi star.
I do not. This is the way I like it. So there's a somewhat disconcerting asymmetry between psi and psi star here, right? But in fact, there isn't. You can also write this term as minus IH bar psi star dot psi. The two terms differ by a full time derivative, right? The time derivative of psi star psi IH bar. And in the Lagrangian, you're allowed to do that, right? So you can add to the Lagrangian any full time derivative or any gradient, and it'll only give you some boundary term and will not affect the equations of motion when you minimize the action, right? You can make it even more symmetric by taking a superposition of these two terms weighted by half. Right? So let's write down the equations of motion for field psi star and psi. All right, so we'll be minimizing the action with respect to psi star. And in the first incarnation, this would give us IH psi psi dot minus, plus h bar squared gradient squared psi divided by 2m equal to 0. Right? So we're differentiating with respect to psi star. Here we're differentiating with respect to the gradient of psi star and then taking the gradient with a minus sign. The other Lagrange equations for this field. Okay? If I do the same thing for the field psi, I will differentiate with respect to psi dot in the first instance, and I'll have to take the time derivative with respect to it, right? So it'll be minus I h bar psi dot star, and then plus h bar squared grad squared psi star over 2m equal to 0.
Sorry, one question regarding this first term, isn't that just the zero component of some kind of probability density? So I mean, it's linked to the boundary.
No, no, no. This is not a boundary term, right? This is not a full-time derivative of something.
Right? But it looks like some kind of J0 or something like this, right?
In a relativistic field theory, it would be the charge density. This is a non-relativistic field theory, so the charge density would be psi star psi. Okay, so that's not. The first term gives rise, and this is what it represents, right? What is this? It's the Schrödinger equation for a free particle, right? So I could have started with the Schrödinger equation for a free particle, which presumably our bosons should obey, right? If you now take the ansatz in which psi of r and t is a plane wave, so its dependence on time and position are exponential, e to minus I omega t plus I k dot r, then you can plug it in. The time derivative becomes multiplication by minus I omega. The gradient becomes I times k. And so you will find that h bar omega minus h bar squared k squared over 2m is equal to 0. And that gives us the energy momentum relation for a non-relativistic particle. So if we had a relativistic field theory, then instead of this term, we would have something like h bar squared over 2m c squared psi dot, okay? And combining this term and that term will give you something relativistically Lorentz invariant, and you would have the more familiar expressions. But here we're not dealing with a relativistic case. So that's our theory. So this could be thought of as a kinetic energy of the field psi, right? So it's proportional, something proportional to its velocity squared. This is not a kinetic energy, but it's something that you may have seen already in one of my previous lectures when we dealt with the ferromagnet. Its dynamics was somewhat similar. We didn't have a kinetic energy, but we had something that I called the Berry phase term, or the geometric phase term. The name comes from having this integrated would get rid of the time dependence, entirely, right? So integral of this over time would give you just something that depends on the geometry of the trajectory, but not on the time dependence. Anyway, take this as it is. It's just the Lagrangian that represents the Schrodinger equation. So then in this case, if we identify frequency with energy and wave number, wave vector with momentum, then we obtain epsilon equal to p squared divided by 2m, as we should. In fact, we can go further and quantize this theory. Which would be the canonical quantization. In this case, have you done canonical quantization in the quantum field theory courses? Yes. So what we do in this case is we introduce first a momentum field pi, which would be the derivative of the Lagrangian density with respect to the velocity, right? So which is psi dot of r. If we perform this operation, here we have psi dot. So when we differentiate the Lagrangian with respect to that, we will find I h psi star of r. And we can write down the Hamiltonian density, which would be pi of r times psi dot of r minus the Lagrangian, momentum times velocity minus the Lagrangian, same as for particles. And that will lead to the cancellation of this term, right? Since pi is ih psi star, adding this term and then subtracting that gets rid of it. So this will be simply h bar squared gradient of psi star times gradient of psi divided by 2m. So as I said, there is no kinetic energy in this case. There's nothing that contains psi dot anymore. And there is just the potential energy here. So strictly speaking, this is not quite the right form of the Hamiltonian. What is wrong with it? What is the Hamiltonian expressed in? Coordinates and momenta, right? So I have to replace psi star with pi, right? So this would be something like minus ih bar over 2m times grad pi on grad psi or something. But I like this form. So we'll come back to that. So we've written the Hamiltonian. What's the quantization procedure? What do we do to quantize this field? What was that? Commutation relation. So the first thing we do is we promote our coordinates and momenta to operators. In this case, we promote the fields to operator fields, right? So operator fields psi of r and pi of r such that psi commutes with itself at different points. And so does pi. But pi and psi do not commute, right? So pi of r, psi of r prime, this commutator would be ih bar times the delta function of r minus r prime. So I apologize for writing in the partly invisible space. That's yes. So it should be psi and pi. And from these, we can switch to more convenient operators, but let me do something else. Let me, instead of writing this, let me write the commutator of psi and psi star. Essentially, it's going to be the same, except I will have to divide by ih bar, right? So I will get the delta function of r minus r prime, which looks very nice. So from here, I can go to the creation and annihilation operators, which are just Fourier transforms of these fields. So I will write psi of r. I will do this in a finite volume. So it will be 1 over square root of v times the sum over momenta or wave vectors multiplied by ak e to ik dot r. So these are annihilation operators, and psi star would be expanded in a similar way. 1 over square root of v times the sum of wave numbers a dagger k e2 minus ik dot r. And I can, from these definitions, I can write the inverse Fourier transforms in which I express ak and a dagger k in terms of psi and psi star. And I can obtain the commutation relations for these operators, right? So you can anticipate that two A operators will what? They will commute, right? There's superpositions of psi's, and all psi's commute with each other. So the same applies to A daggers. But AK's and A dagger K's will not necessarily commute, right? Because they're made of psi and psi stars, and those sometimes do not commute. What do you think the result will be? Kronecker delta, right? Because these are now discrete momenta, and so we'll have the Kronecker delta of K and K prime. These are bona fide creation and annihilation operators.
Are you setting periodic boundary conditions?
Yeah. So standard trick in theoretical physics, you have periodic boundary conditions which select certain wave vectors, right? So that the plane waves are periodic as you move in any direction in your three-dimensional volume. And so building on that, one can write the Hamiltonian in terms of these operators. It would be just the sum over k, h bar squared, k squared over 2m, kinetic energy times a dagger k, ak, and that's pretty much the Hamiltonian of an ideal Bose gas at zero temperature. Or in fact, at any temperature less than the temperature of the Bose-Einstein condensation, what happens when Bose-Einstein condensation occurs? Right. So if we call these quantities n sub k, these are the occupation numbers of boson modes with a given momentum h bar k, we know that at t equal to 0, all nk vanish except the occupation number of the mode with zero momentum, which has all the particles in that state. At higher temperatures, you will have a finite fraction of particles in that state, and then there will be some distribution of bosons in the other momentum states. So you've done that at some point, I believe. Sorry?
Are you saying that this is the Hamiltonian that f is equal to 0, right?
Yeah.
Where did we assume that that was the case?
Well, I did not consider excitations here, but in principle, this will work at finite temperatures as well. The only thing you have to worry about is that once you go above the temperature of Bose-Einstein condensation, you will have to subtract the chemical potential here, which will be non-zero, right? So this form assumes that mu is equal to 0, which is valid for T less than the temperature of Bose-Einstein condensation.
So effectively not a Hamiltonian, it's Hamiltonian minus mu
n. Minus mu n, yes. So in principle, I have to work with the grand potential, so H minus mu times n would be this. And generally, I will have to subtract the chemical potential from the kinetic energy. Very good. So I'm going to pay special attention to the mode with zero momentum, h bar k equal to 0. Below the Bose-Einstein condensation temperature, the occupation number of this mode is macroscopic. All the other modes will have finite occupation numbers, but this becomes infinite in the limit of an infinite system. Right? So this mode is special. And in fact, if I look at these operators, I can't, strictly speaking, write this in the opposite order, right? Because they don't commute. This number would be n0 plus 1. But since the numbers are macroscopic, the difference is tiny, relatively speaking. Right? So I can forget about the non-commutativity of these two quantities, and I can just think of them as numbers. So I can just replace them with square root of n0 times some complex phase. And a dagger 0 would be square root of n0 times the opposite phase. Also, I'm looking at the product of these two operators. And I see that although they don't commute, their non-commutativity makes very little difference. Yeah, right. The occupation number is huge. Therefore, whether it's n0 or n0 plus 1 makes very little difference. And so I can basically replace them with numbers. And so that means singling out the specific mode. And I will have my Fourier transform written in a slightly different way. So psi of r would be, well, let me take this out. So this would be square root of n0 divided by v e to I theta plus the sum over 1 over square root of volume times the sum over non-zero momenta. And here I just have the regular Fourier transform expansion. And psi star of r, or psi dagger of r, similarly would be the square root of n0 over v times e to minus I theta, again, plus the rest of the Fourier transform. So in fact, in order to make a useful shorthand, I'll just write this thing as psi 0, and this I will call psi 0 star. And I will even assign a name to these variables. I'll call this the condensate amplitude. So it's the square of its absolute value gives me the number of particles in the with zero momentum. And one more innovation here, I can call, just write a shorthand that this is psi zero plus delta psi. And this would be psi zero star plus delta psi star. So in this new notation, if I write the Hamiltonian minus mu times n, this would still be the sum over k, h bar squared k squared over 2m times a dagger k a k. Because the zero momentum mode is not affected by anything, its kinetic energy is zero to begin with. Right? So it wasn't present in the sum, so I can include it or exclude it at will. And so this would still be the same as the integral d3r grad h bar squared grade delta psi star dot grad del psi over 2m. So just like before, right? So this subtraction of psi zero, the condensate wave function, does not do anything. But if you think about the number of particles, then this condensate wave function participates, right? So you will have psi zero squared times the volume. And then plus the sum over k non-zero a dagger k a k. Any questions?
Psi zero here is, well, n zero times v, right?
It's square root of n zero over v times the phase factor. So it's n zero over v square root. So if you want to express n zero, this would have to be psi squared times the volume.
Right there.
Yeah. So that's right. This would be at zero temperature, or this is the number of bosons with h bar k equal to zero, right? So that is the total number of bosons. Yeah.
We started out with the single particle Schrödinger equation with a second quantization, and then ended up with something describing very many particles. That seems a bit dubious.
No, I didn't say that we started with a single particle wave function. We started with a field. And if you quantize a field, you get particles. Right? It looks like the Schrödinger equation for a single particle. So the wave function of a single particle is the classical limit of the quantum field. That's the relation.
Shouldn't the classical limit of the Bose field be a many particle wave function?
Yeah, it's the classical limit of the Bose field is pretty much the many particle wave function. But since all the particles, almost all the particles are in the same state, right? That's the wave function of that state. Bosons like to be in the same state.
Okay.
PC.
So this was done in the statistical mechanics course, right? So what you do is you take this expression here, right? And so the number of particles would be this n0 plus the sum over k not equal to 0, n sub k, right? N sub k is the number of bosons in a given mode. And at a finite temperature, n sub k is 1 divided by the exponential of inverse temperature epsilon k minus mu minus 1, right? That's the Bose distribution. So what we do then is we start at high temperatures when we're above the Bose-Einstein condensation temperature, where the chemical potential would be non-zero. And there is no condensate, right? So N0 is zero, or some finite number. Right, so what you do then is you set the condition that the sum of N of k should give you the total number of particles, which becomes an integral as you go to a large system volume. Right, so you'll have this, 1 over E2 beta epsilon k minus mu minus 1 equal to the number of particles divided by by the volume, which gives you density. So for a given temperature, this gives the chemical potential. So you'll find that as the temperature goes down, the chemical potential approaches 0, and at some point it hits 0. So this is the temperature of Bose-Einstein condensation, because you cannot let the chemical potential cross 0 for bosons. Right? If you have bosons with 0 energy, their number blows up according to this, right? If epsilon minus mu is 0, you have 1 divided by 0. So you'll have an infinite number of these bosons. So mu can only go as far as 0 or just slightly below 0, right? And so at that point, the number of particles in the mode with the lowest energy becomes effectively infinite. So no, it's still true. Mu is barely below 0, right?
Right, but this would predict a distribution for any non-zero temperature, right? But you're saying for any temperature below UVC, it's all in one state. So it wouldn't.
No.
Oh, no?
There will be particles in these states with non-zero momenta, right? If epsilon is positive, then it's going to be just some finite number. Right?
So the
distribution will look like this. This is epsilon k, or k, and this is mk. Right? So the distribution would be increasing, and then at zero momentum, there will be a peak like this. Right? So the number of particles in the zero momentum state is much greater than the number of particles in any other mode. All the other modes will have something like this.
Defined as the temperature at which the number of particles in the zero momentum state goes finite?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
But there's always.
So, to the right of this point, zero is not special. It just has the greatest number of particles, but not qualitatively different from all the other momenta.
Yeah.
Right? And then at this point, we find a qualitative difference because now there's a finite fraction of the particles in that state. Well, you do actually, but it's if you divide by the volume, then essentially it will be zero. So n would be finite, and if you divide by the volume, right, the fraction of the particles in that state becomes essentially zero. Right? So zero momentum just becomes like all other momenta. Right, your particles are distributed all over the place, and zero is nothing special. Well, because for k equals zero, this would be zero anyway. So you may include it or you may not include it. It wouldn't make a difference, as long as mu is zero. Any other burning questions? Okay, so let's move on to the interacting Bose gas. So our goal will be to show that the spectrum of excitations in an interacting Bose gas is different from the spectrum of excitations in an ideal Bose gas, and it has precisely the right form. There is a wedge at low momenta. Instead of a quadratic dispersion, you get a linear dispersion. So again, I will start with the classical field theory that has essentially the same Lagrangian up to a point. So you have this Berry phase term. You have the gradient squared term. And then there is an interaction piece psi star, psi star, psi psi, four particle interaction. So you've seen a term like that in the 5-4 theory, I believe. Okay. Now I will have to subtract the chemical potential also. So it's mu times the density, because although I could discard this term describing the ideal Bose gas below the condensation temperature, because mu was zero, we will find that generally mu is non-zero for the interacting Bose gas. So the addition of these two terms is the new element compared to the previous case. I can repeat the same states, introduce the momentum field, quantize this thing, and I will have the quantum Hamiltonian in the grand potential, H minus mu n, would be something like this. It would be, again, the sum over k, h bar squared k squared over 2m minus mu times a dagger k ak. So that takes care of this term, which gives the gradient squared or k squared, takes care of the chemical potential term. And this term is gone, as you recall, because it's linear in the time derivative. The interaction term gives us the following. It's going to be this 1 over the volume, the sum over a set of momenta, which I will decipher shortly. And here we'll have g over 2 multiplying two creation operators, a dagger k4, a dagger k3, times a k2, a k1, a pair of annihilation operators. So what this term describes is a two-particle collision. You have two particles coming with momenta k1 and k2, and two particles coming out with momenta k3 and k4. So it's just collisions of particles with the amplitude equal to g over 2. G is a positive quantity, which corresponds to repulsive interactions. Very good question. So you can, it's very hard to model realistic interactions, which actually are distance dependent and so on, right? So instead of something as simple as this, which I can just write as 1/2 g times the density squared, right? I would have to write something different. It would be the integral over space, the integral over space again, n of r times some kernel g of r minus r prime times n of r prime. This would be a more realistic interaction, right? When I take the Fourier transform of this, I would have this where g is k dependent. So this is a simple, crude caricature of that.
But like, my question is, if like you say the interaction is repulsive, so the only interaction I know from the Hamiltonian is the Van der Waals interaction between Hamiltonian, but in that case it is attractive. So.
the Van der Waals interaction is attractive at long distances, but it's repulsive at short distances. So in fact, in helium, interactions are repulsive at short distances because two helium atoms don't really like to bump into each other. Their electronic shells repel very strongly. But there is attraction at long distances. So yes, a realistic interaction potential would be something like that, where I would have to specify that form. But since here we'll be interested in low momenta, think of this as this vertex evaluated for k1, k2, k3, and k4 close to zero. Then it'll be just a constant, right? Or you can think in terms of the renormalization group where expanding g in the powers of k will give you terms that are less relevant than the zero momentum term. Well, so what you do is instead of minimizing things with respect to your fields, you minimize things with a constraint, right? The constraint is n is a fixed number. So if you minimize the energy, you might as well minimize energy minus n times the Lagrange multiplier. That's the short answer.
If we are interested in the k small, right, doesn't that mean that we are ignoring the short distance?
If g is negative, in fact, the Bose gas will collapse. So you have to have strong enough repulsion in the problem. So overall, the interactions have to be repulsive. Turns out that in helium, at short, at small wave numbers, the interaction is repulsive. But in fact, there are important consequences of g having that structure. And it does affect the excitation spectrum, but we don't have time to discuss that. So if you're interested in a longer discussion about this, feel free to come to me on Wednesday and we can have a blast. Okay. But we have to press on. We have a few minutes left, so I want to complete this thing, right? So I can write my Lagrangian as two parts. One part would be the kinetic piece, or the Berry phase piece. And then the other part would be some potential that depends on psi. And this potential includes the standard kinetic, or this piece, the gradient of psi squared. But it also has 1/2 g psi to the fourth minus mu times psi squared. So this part is independent of the gradient. And if we're interested in the equilibrium state or in the ground state, it will have psi equal to a constant, right? It's uniform in space. And so what we need to do in order to determine the value of psi in the ground state, we just minimize this potential. Have you seen this potential before? The name Mexican hat mean anything to you? That's the Mexican hat potential. All right, so if you plot this thing as a function of psi, pretending that this is a real field, right? So it starts out at zero, and then it goes down, and it comes up. So it's something like this. And now you have to imagine, since there is the real part and there is the imaginary part of psi, that this is a, you have to rotate this thing, and so it will create a trough of minima. So there'll be some trough of minima where you will have a degenerate ground state. So if you minimize with respect to psi this thing, you will have, right, so you differentiate with respect to psi squared, for instance, you'll get g psi squared minus mu equal to zero. And so your equilibrium value of psi is the square root of mu divided by g. And since what we usually control is the number of particles and their density, right? So the density of particles, which is n, would be given by psi zero squared. So that's mu divided by g. And so that sets the chemical potential. So the chemical potential will be g times psi naught squared, or g times n. It's non-zero, you see. If you have no interactions, or if your system is empty, then the chemical potential is zero. But now we see that it's not. So we had to include it. So the magnitude of the wave function, this psi field, is fixed by the density or by the chemical potential, but the phase is not, right? So we can write psi zero is the square root of n times e to I theta, where n is fixed, but theta is arbitrary. In fact, what we're dealing with here is a spontaneous symmetry breaking. Our Lagrangian there has a global U1 symmetry. If you multiply psi by an arbitrary phase and psi star by the opposite phase, the Lagrangian will not change. Right, so we have a global U1 symmetry. And picking a specific phase violates that symmetry. So as I mentioned several times already, spontaneous breaking of a continuous symmetry generates Goldstone modes. Right, so there'll be a mode whose frequency goes to zero as the wave number goes to zero. So we expect Goldstone modes. Excitations with very low frequencies, or low energies if we translate this to particles.
Is that obtained by putting spatial variations in the space?
Sorry?
Like taking a theta constant to a theta.
No, so we know that if we change the phase globally, if we rotate theta everywhere, the energy will not change, right? And if we change it slowly, the energy presumably will be low. And so that will result in the frequency of the corresponding oscillations that are small.
Okay, but do you necessarily know that it vanishes linearly?
Or? We don't, okay. But it will be seen that it does vanish linearly, okay, in this case. So what I'm going to do next is I'm going to start with an equilibrium configuration. Or state in which psi of r is psi 0 of r, which is just the square root of density equilibrium value times e to I theta, uniform in space, and add small deviations from that, right? So I'm going to study how the field reacts to small inhomogeneities in it. So now psi of r would be this psi 0 of r plus small fluctuations. And psi 0, in fact, does not depend on r, so it's just a constant in space, right? So I'm going to write out my Lagrangian in terms of these things. And in fact, it's a good idea to switch to a couple of new variables, which would be the amplitude in the phase or the density in the phase. So I'm translating this Lagrangian into the language of n and theta, right? So from psi to n and theta, psi and psi star, right? And the translation is as follows. It's square root of n times e to I theta. So if I write out the first term, for example, there will be differentiation with respect to time of both the density and the angular variable, right? So my Lagrangian will look like this. It would be IH bar n dot divided by 2, right? So I differentiate square root of n, and there'll be a factor of half as a result of that, minus H bar n times theta dot. So these are the two terms that come out from the first term. The gradient term will look like this. It will be H bar squared n divided by 2m, and here you will have gradient of density divided by density squared plus the gradient of the angle squared. And then the last two terms do not involve the phase. They just depend on the density, right? So it will be minus 1 half gn squared plus mu m. So that's the way it looks. I'm going to discard this term. What allows me to do that? No. It's just the full time derivative, right? It's ddt of something. That does not affect the equations of motion. So I can discard this with impunity. Okay, so this term I will keep, and all of these terms I will keep too. And so now I can expand in fluctuations from equilibrium. So my n becomes some initial n0 plus delta n. Delta n depends on r. My theta becomes theta 0 plus delta theta, which depends on r. So the fluctuations may be spatially non-uniform. So these are my new fields, right? This and that, and theta naught and n naught are just numbers that correspond to a certain uniform state. I start with a uniform state, and then I expand in its powers.
N naught is such that you're in the ground state.
Right, exactly. So n naught is psi naught squared, and it's the particle density. Yeah, I apologize for the large number of n zeros here, all with different meanings, some capital, some not, but I hope that it's clear what this n zero means. Okay, so we just write this out. The Lagrangian will have two kinetic pieces. One would be minus h bar n zero times delta theta time derivative. And again, this is a term that I can discard, right? N0 is a constant, so this is just a time derivative. Doesn't count. And then I have minus h bar delta n times delta theta dot. By the way, this indicates that, again, n and theta are canonically conjugate fields. So the phase of our wave function is momentum conjugate to the density. I can write out these things, and I'm going to keep just terms that are at most quadratic in my new fields. I'm going to discard the cubic and quartic and all higher order terms, because as you can see, there will be some nonlinearities here, some enharmonic terms, but I'm just interested in keeping things as simple as possible, just small deviations from equilibrium. So I'll have minus h bar squared equilibrium density and naught over 2m times the gradient of the density fluctuation divided by 2n0 squared. So since I have already delta n to the second order, this is a number and this is a number. I don't need to keep anything higher than that. And this term just changes in a simple way. It's the gradient of angle fluctuation. So looking at this term, I will have something zeroth order in delta n, right? So it'll be just minus 1 half gn0 squared plus mu times n0. And these terms I can discard because these are, again, constants, right? So I don't care for the constants. Will there be a first order term in delta n? No, why not? Because we're at the minimum of the potential energy, right? So we already selected the value of n that minimizes the potential energy. And so the zeroth order, first order term will be absent. And the coefficient of the second order term will be just minus half g, right? Because delta n squared comes only from this term, but not from that term. So it's minus 1 half g delta n squared. Plus terms higher order. In the fluctuations. So all the terms that I've kept are explicitly quadratic in our fluctuations, right? So all these terms are quadratic. So let me illustrate the setting. This is our real part of psi. This is our imaginary part of psi. This is the circle on which the potential energy is minimized. And that gives us, right, so this is square root of density n0. This is square root of density n0. And the angle is arbitrary. So we're expanding our Lagrangian in the vicinity of this point. We've chosen some theta naught, and we're allowing fluctuations both in this direction and in that direction. Imagine that this is the potential energy axis, and so you will have some potential energy landscape that has a local maximum over here, then it dips down into the board to acquire a minimum on this circle, and then it increases towards you again, right? So this is where the minimum is. As you go in this direction, what happens? You have a parabolic potential there, and it's given precisely by this term, right? So if I write out my Lagrangian again, so I have the kinetic piece with a single time derivative, then gathering the terms for delta n, I will have minus h bar squared divided by, actually this is 4, 8 m naught, mn naught times gradient of delta n squared. And I have that, minus 1 half g delta n squared. And I have a similar potential term for the angle, right? But the difference between the n direction and the theta direction is that I have a parabolic well for the n direction, but I have no parabolic well for the theta direction. In fact, changes in theta are not penalized, but right, because all these values have the same energy. The energy is the same regardless of theta, but there is a penalty for going off the circle in the radial direction. And so that's the perfect setting for the Goldstone mode mechanism. And normally, as you will discuss later in your quantum field theory course, there would be one mode that is massive, and it's the fluctuations in this direction, and the other mode is massless. This is your Goldstone boson. That would be the case if the two modes had their own kinetic energies. That is, there would be a piece delta n dot squared plus delta theta dot squared. Then your Lagrangian falls apart into two pieces, one for delta n and the other for delta theta. You have two independent fields that are doing something on their own. Right? So one, delta n, would be a massive field. The other would be a massless field. Well, no such luck here. We don't have two separate kinetic pieces, right? We have a common kinetic piece. And so it turns out that they have to cooperate. So instead of having two modes, one with the frequency like this, some mass squared term plus momentum squared term, and the other just k squared, you will have the geometric mean between the two. You won't have two modes, you will have a single mode. So instead of this, you will have something that looks like this, square root of k squared times m squared plus k squared. So we'll just derive it. I'm telling you what the results are. In case you're itching to leave, this is the most important message, right? So it will be proportional to k for k going to 0. And it would be, again, k squared at high momenta, right? So as we anticipate at high momentum, it should be just, you know, interactions will be not particularly important, and you will recover the free particle, omega proportional to k squared. But at low momenta, you get omega proportional to k. So this is the excuse for having no viscosity. So as we discussed, if you have a linear spectrum at small k, then you have no viscosity because you're unable to generate particles as a macroscopic object moves through the fluid. Okay, so let's derive that. Now all we need to do is just obtain the equations of motion. So let's start with the equation of motion for delta n. So we're going to differentiate with respect to delta n the action, right? So from this piece, we'll get minus h bar delta theta dot. From here, we'll get the gradient squared with the plus sign for m n zero. Red squared delta n. And from the parabolic piece, we'll get minus g delta n equal to 0. Equation of motion for the theta field, we again differentiate this, but we differentiate with respect to theta dot, and therefore there'll be a time derivative. So it's minus h bar going to plus h bar times delta n dot. And there's only one potential piece, this. So it gives us plus exactly h bar squared n zero divided by m times grad squared delta theta equal to 0. So these are our equations of motion. They're linear in the fluctuations, delta theta and delta n. So we can use a plane wave ansatz to solve it. Delta n and delta theta as a functions of time and space would be some amplitude delta n naught, delta theta naught, times e to minus I omega t plus I k dot r. So the time derivative becomes minus I omega, the spatial derivative becomes minus k, and we obtain the following matrix equation. Right, so these pieces will give minus h bar squared k squared over 4m and 0, minus g, that's the diagonal piece, because it multiplies delta n. The off-diagonal piece would be plus I h bar omega. In the second line, this would be minus I h bar omega off-diagonal piece. And the diagonal one would be minus h bar squared k squared n 0 over m. So this multiplies the column delta n 0, delta theta 0, and this is equal to 0. So it's a matrix equation. Well, if a matrix times a vector gives you 0, what can you say about the matrix? Its determinant should be 0, right? Because one of its eigenvalues is 0. So we write that the determinant of this is 0. So the determinant would be this times this, the diagonal pieces, minus the off-diagonal pieces multiplied. So you have h bar omega squared is equal to h bar squared k squared over 4 m 0 naught plus g times h bar squared divided by m times n naught. So h bar omega is the square root of, let me rewrite this slightly, h bar squared over k squared over 2m times h bar squared k squared over 2m plus 2gm0. That's precisely what I claimed. Right? Large momenta, k going to infinity, h bar omega is h bar squared k squared over 2m. So we just get free particles, as one should expect. Kinetic energy is much bigger than the interaction term. But as k goes to 0, h bar omega, so we can neglect this piece, and we have k squared square root. So it's going to be h bar k times s, where s is a speed. And the speed is g n0 divided by the mass. So the dispersion of these particles, epsilon as a function of momentum will be linear at the lowest momenta, and then it curl up and become parabolic. So it's h bar squared, it's b squared over 2m here, and it's b times s here. So as long as you have a macroscopic object moving through this fluid with a low velocity, less than s, there will be no dissipation. It will not lose its momentum, it will just keep moving. Isn't this wonderful? It's an amazingly simple theory, right? And Landau didn't know any of this. He just postulated that the energy-momentum relation is linear at the bottom. In fact, he figured out quite a bit more about the dispersion of particle excitations in liquid helium. It's a bit more complicated than this. This works for a weakly interacting Bose gas. If you go to liquid helium, it's a strongly interacting Bose gas, and the dispersion actually is more involved. In fact, it looks like this. It goes through a dip before moving up. So this dip is actually the evidence of attraction between helium atoms at long distances. And if you put helium under pressure, this dip goes down and down, and it touches zero, at which point helium crystallizes, becomes a solid. And you might recall that in a solid, you have a dispersion of phonons that goes up and then comes down. So that's a precursor of that. So in fact, in helium, you don't need to exceed this speed. You have to exceed this speed in order to start creating excitations. You won't be creating particles of this type. You'll be creating particles of that type. And Landau called them rotons for an obscure reason. So he knew quite a bit about helium. So it's amazing how much of a theory he was able to construct without going through all this field theoretic argument. But at least our simple field theoretic arguments gives a basis for the renormalization of the energy spectrum that's responsible for this wonderful property of liquid helium-4.
Should S be a square root of that quantity?
Oh, yes, that's right. Sorry.
Also, could you think of excitations about the origin, the local max, or I guess the local max of the Mexican hat as like particles of negative mass or something?
Well, since we don't live near the origin, we live at the minimum, right?
But you could still expand around in the linear term advantage.
Yeah, it will be unstable. You have bosons with negative mass, which means that you can lower the energy by populating the system with more bosons. Okay. And so you'll have a bunch of them.
From the formalism, I get that we just have one excitation, which has this nice linear
space. Exactly.
But is there a good intuitive physical reason for that?
So the physical reason is that these two fields don't have their own lives. If they did, in the form of the kinetic energies, right? If they had each If each of these fields had a kinetic energy, delta theta dot squared and delta n dot squared, there would be two modes, one massive, one massless. But they're forced to live together. They only share one kinetic piece between them. And that's why we only get one mode. So it's like in a ferromagnet. Remember, we could fluctuate magnetization this way and that way. But they don't live separate lives. And that's the reason why in a ferromagnet spins precess. Whereas in an antiferromagnet, you could count them this way and count them that way, the staggered magnetization. And we discovered that they're actually living separate lives.
Does it come from the fact that Lagrangian is first order?
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. So you can only, you cannot try delta theta times delta theta dot, because that would be a full time derivative of delta theta squared over 2. So that would be a useless term, right? And so you have to involve both fields in order to write down a first order time derivative piece. So you have to have n theta dot. You can't just have theta dot.
Why is it that motivates the choice of a Pythagorean theorem?
It's the interactions, right? So if you assume weakly interacting particles, you'll just have a diagram where two particles come together and they move apart, right? So that gives you a phi-fourth term. Or in this case, psi star, psi star, psi.
So what you get out of these calculations is that the particle cannot transfer momentum below a certain velocity threshold. What about the bottom? You could still transfer it.
Yeah, so if you exceed the critical velocity, then there will be viscosity. Yeah, so there is in fact a critical velocity. And in helium, it's not determined by the linear branch, but it's determined by the bottom of the roton branch. Right, yeah. So in fact, I have not touched upon something else, which is what happens at a finite temperature, because at a finite temperature, you will have excitations already present, and your particle can scatter off these excitations. Right? So instead of creating a new excitation, it can just interact with an existing excitation. And it turns out that there will be some viscous component at finite temperatures. And in fact, you can measure how much of a viscous component there is, and it turns out that its density goes to zero as temperature goes to zero. So at finite temperatures, your superfluid helium-4 behaves as if it were made out of two fluids, one viscous and the other non-viscous. And in fact, the part that comes through these pores in the movie is the non-viscous part, which carries zero entropy. And you can basically change temperature in this way, and there are all kinds of wonderful effects. So I urge you to watch this movie. Liquid helium has lots of weird properties, and they all stem from this combination of two fluids. One of which is really interesting. Yeah?
So this whole theory has a local, a global new one symmetry.
Yes.
So what is the concept of charge related to this?
Particle number.
Isn't it related to something with electric dynamics?
Well, not in this case. There is no electric charge. Right? And as we saw, theta is canonically conjugate to n. So that's another expression of this. All right, very good. So, see you tomorrow.